Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much. How are you, more importantly?
Yes. So for listeners, we didn't have an episode last week because I was in quarantine. Now we should point out I did not have the coronavirus COVID-19
yet.
I had an antique disease, mumps, which I didn't think I was supposed to get because I had the inoculations as a kid, but I guess that doesn't always work. So yes, I have a recent quarantine experience, and I may have another quarantine experience in the future.
Sorry, did you finish your intro? I have a question about your quarantine.
That's all I was going to say.
Well, because this week we want to talk about epidemic diseases.
Epidemic diseases in light of the COVID-19 global epidemic.
Yeah, so can I ask you though, David? I don't want to be too personal about this, but what was being in quarantine like?
Well, the internet's an amazing thing. And so, usually I think the thing people worry about with quarantine is it's really boring. And I guess it was moderately boring, but I had things to do, so it was fine.
So did you just binge watch Netflix? And
Pretty much, yeah.
Right.
Okay. I tend to watch, and this nobody cares about this, but I tend to watch like Star Trek Next Generation, things that are very comforting when I'm ill.
Right. Well, fair enough. I think that's very sweet.
I tend not to watch new things. I don't watch things that I already know how it's going to end.
And you're feeling better.
Oh, yeah. I feel great. Yeah.
Right. And listeners, he looks great too.
I had a few days of feeling very not well, yes.
So do you have any quarantine advice? Because many of us may find ourselves in quarantine.
Make sure you have a good internet connection and make sure you have family members who can get food for you.
So but your family members were they allowed to have contact with you?
It
wasn't like one of these cruise ships where they were leaving the food outside the door.
We tried to minimize contact with my daughter who was visiting from St. Andrews where she's an undergraduate. She came home for the weekend. I tried to sort of minimize being in the same room with her for an abundance of precaution. We would figure that was probably not even necessary. Yeah, because obviously everyone in the family had been vaccinated against mumps.
So how long was the quarantine period?
It was a week.
Right, okay. Interesting.
Right, so a very different kind of disease than the COVID-19, which is really causing pretty global consequences in terms of economics, in terms of businesses are shutting down, sporting events are being put on hold, universities are shutting down, global programs, businesses are telling people not to travel, especially to infected areas. This is a really sort of public health emergency. If you go back to your period, Frank, I guess disease is an epidemic disease is a fairly constant threat. Do you want to talk to them about how disease shaped early American history?
Sure. You're right. It's a constant, in the 17th and 18th centuries because medical technology and medical knowledge isn't what it is today, to be sure. And indeed, the transition is your period, the 19th and early 20th century, but we'll get to that in a second. I think the two, in thinking about this episode, the two real instances that are most important in thinking about early American history are the so-called virgin soil epidemics that affected the indigenous peoples of the New World, basically from the time that Europeans arrived down to about the mid to late 19th century, depending on the space we're talking about and the people involved. As well as there was a massive smallpox epidemic in North America in the late 18th century that coincided with the American Revolution and, in fact, kind of might well have shaped the outcome of that conflict. So I'll just take each of those in turn very briefly. The virgin soil epidemics are so-called, and that phrase was coined by a historical geographer named Alfred Crosby about 50 years ago, were the epidemics that afflicted Native Americans who didn't have the immunities to most common European diseases that the European colonizers did, and African enslaved Africans they brought with them. And as a result of those, because indigenous populations had no immunity or very limited immunity in most cases to common diseases like the flu, but also more serious things like smallpox. They were often wiped out or nearly wiped out, or very, very much higher death rates than among populations with partial immunity. And this...
Even things like the mumps.
In fact, yes, even things like the mumps. I mean, very, you know, things that would be serious illnesses for people in the early modern world, European world or African world, would be deadly for measles, mumps, things like that, for indigenous peoples across the Americas. And this, more than anything, explains the displacement of many indigenous peoples, especially in North America, but also in Central America and South America as well. And so these so-called virgin soil epidemics are a constant in early American history, but especially in those first, that first century after 1492, down to say 1492 to about 1600 or so. When the pilgrims arrived in this, and we were in the year of the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the pilgrims, in what's today Cape Cod in Massachusetts, in 1620, they found cleared fields but no people.
Right, and they say God had provided this fields for
us. Exactly, and they like, said, well, you know, this was Providence. The hand of Providence killed the Indians. no, it, well, that's not how it worked. I mean, European fishermen who brought diseases before. Yeah, and so and there were, of course, indigenous people in southern New England as well who were still present, but their numbers, and then this story was repeated throughout the Americas, their numbers were severely depleted. There was a massive social disruption as a result of epidemic disease. We're seeing that right now. You can't buy hand sanitizer in Edinburgh, and people are stocking up on canned goods. You know, people respond to epidemic diseases in often rational ways, but sometimes irrational ways as well. And so this disruptive constant force is a major factor in explaining the history of colonization and in the so-called New World in the Americas. If we cast our mind forward a couple of centuries to the late 18th century, the period I'm most expert in, that was a period when there was... And Elizabeth, the historian, Elizabeth Fenn, has written the most about this in her book, Pox Americana. There was a smallpox epidemic that was really continent-wide in North America. There was a kind of... And it was interracial. Everybody was affected in some way to a large extent. And
she talks about people in like Mexico all the way up to the Arctic Circle.
That's right. Smallpox. That's right. But it also helps to explain the... prevalence of disease during the American War of Independence. Yeah. Now, all 18th century wars were characterized by epidemic disease because armies, the hygiene in 18th century armies wasn't very, very good and things like that.
And armies are moving around and they're bringing people in concentrations. There's all kinds of ways in which war sort of promulgates epidemic
disease. That's right. And you see this in your period with the Civil War as well. But there was a particularly virulent... smallpox epidemic that kind of overlay that story as well, and that's a factor in the American War of Independence. Interestingly, to reflect on our last episode two weeks ago, our boy George Washington, boy George, he was exposed to smallpox as a relatively young man, and this was actually incredibly helpful to him because he survived and.
That's when he went to Barbados.
Barbados with his brother, who was himself suffering from tuberculosis. But that meant that, of course, Washington was, you know, smallpox was the scourge of 18th century armies, and he'd acquired immunity to it because he survived. And as a consequence of that, his career as a soldier was possible. There's the kind of general instance of these so-called virgin soil epidemics, and then the particular instance in the late 18th century that are particularly important. One aspect of this, which is interesting to me, is they're beginning to experiment with a kind of early form of inoculation. It's not a vaccine so much as inoculation, and so you expose people to a mild form of the disease, and then they're placed in quarantine, as you've just been for a period of time. And many people in the 18th century grapple with the decision as to whether to undertake this procedure or not, because it can be deadly.
Yeah, so you're getting, it's called variolation.
That's
right. You're basically making an incision in the person's, usually in their arm, infecting them with the disease, and then they get sort of a mild case of it. And then get immunity as a consequence.
That's right.
You know, this, you know, which I guess was a technique that was developed in the early 18th century, and it was extraordinarily controversial on both sides of the Atlantic, because people said, like, this is, you know, you're playing God in some ways. There was, an episode with Cotton Mather where he was advocating doing this, and people firebombed his house because they thought it was sort of unnatural what he was advocating.
And it was risky. Yeah, you know, yeah. Some people got a full-blown case of whatever the disease was and died.
And you are contagious,
yes,
when you are, you know, when you have this inoculation. And so, you know, you have I guess one of the choices Washington had to make was, okay, he's got this huge army, some of whom have immunity because they've had the disease. A bunch of them, though, didn't.
Right, that's right.
And the Continental Army had less immunity than, say, the British soldiers or the German soldiers did, just because of the ways in which sort of population dynamics worked at the time. You know, and Washington has to make the choice, do I inoculate my soldiers or not? And if he does, then you know, they are vulnerable for a time because the entire army's sick. And so what, you know, I think Washington eventually says originally no, and then he eventually decides to inoculate his...
Yeah, well, he has a more personal decision because he has to decide at one point whether to inoculate his stepson.
Oh, geez.
Jackie Custis, and he does, but he does so without really telling Martha, because Martha, his wife and the mother of this young man, was really worried about losing, experienced a lot of death in her life, particularly among her children. And so, they're very reluctant. She's very reluctant to do this. Mm-hmm. Jackie and George get together and do it, and he survives, and it was a good decision. But he worries about that. And Abigail Adams has to make a similar decision with her children while John Adams is away.
Mm.
So this is a good example of the kind of empowerment of women as a result of the war, if you will, or the pressure on women as a result of war during that period. But yeah, Washington eventually, they eventually accept it in the Continental Army, but it's not uncontroversial. And I did a little research in an earlier book I wrote on Americans who were held prisoners by the British who are inoculating themselves on prison hulks or in prison camps.
Jeez.
Yeah. But the conditions are so bad and smallpox is so rife that they want to do it in order to survive. So it's a very interesting moment in the history of epidemics in America. What about in your period, David, in the 19th century?
In the 19th century, you have outbreaks of epidemic disease all the time. And communities choosing to quarantine themselves. I mean, one of the questions I think that runs throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century, and I think something we're wrestling with today, is what is the power of the state to do it? What's the obligation of the state to do something about public health? And what is the power that the state has to compel people to do things that they may or may not want to do? So you have outbreaks of smallpox, you have outbreaks of typhoid fever, you've got outbreaks of yellow fever in various places, especially in the South, which is a disease spread by...
Yeah, yellow fever is a scourge in the 1790s, too.
Yeah, but throughout the 19th century, you have outbreaks in New Orleans and in Charleston and Savannah. And one of the things about some of these outbreaks is that they have both an impulse to have a government response to them, but they also really don't necessarily know how these diseases are spread. They don't really know the mechanisms for them. And, with yellow fever, for instance, we now know it's spread by a mosquito. They didn't know that in the 19th century. And so they they had various ideas.
Miasma.
Exactly. And so people were worried, like, if we get mail from places that are having yellow fever outbreaks, are we going to get yellow fever from the mail? And so they smoke, letters that are coming out of Charleston hoping that they're going to kill the disease because they think it's spread by asthma or whatever. I think one of the more interesting cases, there's a couple of really interesting cases from the early part of the 20th century, I think, sort of speaks to this question about the power of the state. The first has to do with a woman who was commonly called Typhoid Mary, who was...
Yes, born... we've all heard of her, but tell us the story.
Her real name is Mary Mallon. She was an Irish immigrant. But she was born in Ireland, immigrated to the United States. She worked as a cook, and she worked as a cook for wealthy families in New York City.
Where was she born? What are her approximate
dates? 1869. She died in 1938. You know, this is sort of the apex of a certain kind of Gilded Age wealth in New York, where everyone had a cook and whatever. And the interesting thing about her was she, as her name, Typhoid Mary Ball, she carried typhoid, but she was asymptomatic. And so she would go and she would cook for families and they would get sick, but she herself demonstrated no symptoms, seemed to be perfectly healthy. And you know, she's one of the first cases of
asymptomatic. How did they identify her?
Basically, they did some gum, you know, shoe leather epidemiology where they sort of traced, okay, we have this patch of people who are getting sick with typhoid, this other patch of people who get sick with typhoid, this third patch, and what do they have in common? This person cooked all the food for them.
Right.
And they what happens in 1907 is they arrest her, basically, and they quarantine her on this island off of Manhattan, which had a hospital and a quarantine facility. Lots of places had quarantine facilities for people with contagious disease. And she was outraged. She said, look, there's nothing wrong with me. You know, I'm not a leper. I don't have smallpox. I don't have any outward sign of disease. What power do you as the state have to hold me against my will? I'm fine. And they held her initially for 3 years, and they eventually release her. But they tell her, look, we want you not to work as a cook anymore because we think you are contagious. We've arranged for you to get a job.
How long was she contagious?
She was contagious her whole life. When they did an autopsy.
I don't know anything about typhus.
It's typhoid, which is a different type of disease. Yeah. They actually did an autopsy when she died, and they found the disease in one of her internal organs.
Right, okay.
So they release her. They say, well, cook, we don't want you to work as a cook. We want you to work as a laundress. And she said, look, laundresses make half as much as cooks do. I can't make a living as a laundress. I can make a living as a cook. So she goes back and ends up working as a cook. A bunch more people get sick. We know at least 50-something people got infected by her, but some people think the numbers actually may be orders of magnitude higher than that because she often moved around and changed employers. And then after the second outbreak that she causes, they quarantine her again, and they quarantine her for the last 23 years of her life, where they sort of make her stay in this small island off the coast, off of Manhattan in the East River, and... you know, the entire time she says, look, I feel fine. I'm not contagious. But, you know, this is one of those places where you're thinking about the power of the state. One of the things that's happening throughout the Progressive Era, and this is obviously during the Progressive Era when this happens, is there's a real emphasis towards creating public health and towards creating this idea that the state has an obligation not only to, you know, build streets and schools and things, but also to maintain public health, and that was not simply, healthcare wasn't simply an individual choice, but something that was a collective responsibility. So people start to look into, you know, Typhoid Mary is connected to all kinds of campaigns for clean water, for better sanitation, for getting rid of spittoons that were every place, getting rid of the common drinking cup that you would have had at water fountains, which turns out is a really bad idea. You know, and it comes along at the same time that you have modern understandings about germ theory, being both disseminated not only in the medical community more broadly, where people understand that having contagious people is a threat not only to themselves and to the people around them, but to the community more broadly. And so I think this, you know, Typhoid Mary is an interesting case thinking about, you know, the moment we're in right now, about what power does the state have to deal with an epidemic like this? To what extent does the state have the right to take away people's liberty to prevent them from spreading disease? We have all these cases of people being quarantined and people then trying to escape quarantine, or people trying to, you know, fearful of getting diagnosed with COVID-19 because they're worried not so much about the disease, but they're worried about being stuck in a facility for, you know, period of you know, days or weeks as a consequence. And we can think about the people who have been on cruise ships recently, where, you know, they say they are fine, but then they, you know, feel that the real hardship is in their minds is in the quarantine.
Well, there's the new cruise ship. Well, not new, but the latest is one off in San Francisco, where they're holding several hundred people on a cruise ship.
Yeah.
There. And but self-quarantining is of limited value. So the first coronavirus case in New Hampshire is a guy who was diagnosed and told to self-quarantine, but he went off to he went out to a concert apparently at Dartmouth. So there's a little bit of concern.
Self-quarantine, except for going to
yeah. So you, turns out you need to you know, if you're told to self-quarantine,
listeners, if you're told to self-quarantine, we have a lot of back episodes you can listen to. You may be sick of us instead of the disease, but you know, don't go to concerts.
Anyway, yes. Yeah, so yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned progressivism, because that's the what we're seeing is, I guess, Typhoid Mary is a victim. I don't know if that's the right word, of the progressive state, in the sense that the state is exercising that kind of, I guess, you know, in the 18th century, they would have just burned her as a witch or hanged her as a witch.
Well, I mean, I think in the 18th century, they wouldn't have known that she, right. Yeah, I mean, maybe.
Or they wouldn't have known she was.
They wouldn't have figured out, you know, it does require a certain kind of systems of knowledge in order to sort of identify her as the carrier. The other sort of episode from the progressive era that I think is worth talking about in terms of the sort of a precursor or a framing for the COVID-19 outbreak, of course, is the 1918 flu outbreak that goes along with the First World War.
Killed 50 million people worldwide.
Yep. I think that's the upper range. Right. You know, the people have a different estimates, but they think something in the order of one quarter of the world's population got this flu. And I think the thing that strikes me about the flu outbreak in 1918 compared to the one to this COVID-19 today is questions about how you disseminate information about it. Because when that flu first broke out, of course, it's in the very end of the First World War. There's all kinds of controls upon the media. There's all kinds of controls about how you disseminate information. And one of the names that the 1918 flu was given was the Spanish flu. And people often, therefore, think that it started in Spain. It didn't start in Spain. It actually may have started in Kansas. But the reason why it got the name the Spanish flu is Spain, since Spain was not involved in the First World War, they didn't have a media censorship about the flu outbreak there the way that the participants in the war did. And so they reported when, for instance, the king got sick, they reported that in the media. And so people knew about what was going on in Spain and therefore thought that Spain was the epicenter of it.
And of course, it coincided with the end of the war, so millions of soldiers were being demobilized and moving.
I think the war helped spread the disease, and obviously one of the things that was striking about that particular flu was that most strains of flu affect the very young and the very old and people with other kinds of compromised immune systems. The 1918 flu disproportionately killed 18 to 30 year old healthy people. I think that was one of the things that was particularly shocking about it, was that it did target a demographic that usually is able to weather the flu quite well. But thinking about, you know, today and the ways in which the 1918 flu was able to spread around the globe so quickly because of the war, much in the same way that COVID-19 has been able to spread around the world today rather quickly because of our global economy and global networks of trade. You are just about to head off to the United States and you're going to be passing through this global networks of everything. But
yes, nobody's... I'm supposed to go to, I'm supposed to travel up and around the United States in the next couple of weeks. That trip is in doubt now because some of our events have been canceled. But yes, that's right.
So I think that's one of the first places where you do, obviously you see epidemic disease like the smallpox epidemic you talked about in the Revolution spreading around, but that took years for that to happen. Whereas, 1918, the flu was able to spread globally within a matter of months, and likewise, the COVID-19 seems to be spreading extraordinarily rapidly because we are able to be in four different places in four different days if we want to be.
Yes, and I mean, it's very interesting because, of course, it started in Wuhan, China, they believe, but and spread in East Asia, and there are, it's hot spots, if you will, in South Korea.
And Italy.
And Italy. But and Italy, you know, the outbreak in Italy is very, very serious.
Yes. They've canceled the soccer, they've canceled the football. That's which, right, is, which is, if they've canceled football in Italy.
It doesn't get any more serious than that. My son's very upset about that. But indeed, the first case in here in Scotland, I've heard anecdotally, is a case of somebody who picked it up in Italy, and so the movement of people is a major issue in this, and you can map it accordingly. So in the United States right now, the concentration seems to be along the West Coast, although there are cases across the country. So yeah, that's right. It's concentrated in particular places, and we can map those, I guess, but. If it truly becomes a global epidemic or morphs into a pandemic, then it'll be everywhere, and they, you know, it'll cease being possible to map it, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, the question then about quarantine becomes a very different issue. If everybody has it, can you quarantine anybody? I think it works. Quarantine works when you're trying to limit the spread of a disease, but once it's become ubiquitous,
and this seems to be relatively easily transmitted, which is the real issue.
I guess it depends what you're comparing it to, but yeah.
Yeah, well, of course.
Yes. Yes. The other sort of historical episode that sort of strikes me that's relevant to the COVID-19 outbreak has to do with the AIDS crisis from especially in the early phases in the early 1980s.
Well, it's good. Well, in answer to your last question, yeah. I mean, AIDS is something that's less easily transmitted.
Oh, to be sure. Yes.
So I think that's. But anyway, carry on. Yes.
Because one of the striking things thinking about the AIDS crisis as a public health question was the absolute silence of the Reagan administration from the first widespread outbreaks in 1981, 1982. The Reagan administration didn't say anything for basically 5 years, despite the fact that thousands of Americans were dying of AIDS. And obviously this has a large part to do with the fact that the infected populations were not ones the Reagan administration valued very much. That is to say, predominantly gay men and intravenous drug users were a disproportionate number of the cases.
That was called the gay disease.
And I think, you know, thinking about how governments respond, the kinds of choices governments make about public health issues, you know, I think the AIDS crisis is the prime example of a government totally mishandling a crisis and having massive consequences for hundreds of thousands of people as a consequence. I mean, and we're thinking about sort of the ways in which different governments are responding to COVID-19 right now. I think we're seeing a range of different responses. The thing that concerns me very much is the Trump administration seems to be primarily concerned about the effect of the COVID-19 virus on the stock market rather than the effect upon the people who are infected. And so they're very much trying to downplay how widespread it is and downplay the public health steps that should be taken to prevent it.
Well, that's right. I mean, they're making a case that it's, well, he used the word hoax last weekend, saying it's basically a Democratic hoax to make him look bad. So he's, as with everything, he's interpreting it from a personal standpoint. And, you know, this has become a talking point on Fox News that basically this is no worse than the flu, and the flu kills X number of people every year, and we've only had a in the United States, not even a couple of hundred people, just slightly over 100 as of today, have been diagnosed, and therefore it's much ado about nothing, and people are overreacting. The danger for this, with this position and this messaging, is that it will discourage people from taking the measures that are necessary to prevent it from spreading.
Yes.
So actually, it'll be counterproductive. This is the perhaps the most egregious instance, or the most prominent instance, maybe is a better way to put it, so it's less value laden, of a kind of Trump's insisting on that the world is one way and the world being another way, coming into conflict with each other, because biology and science can't be changed. This virus exists and steps will need to be taken. Now, maybe it's not as serious as, you know, yesterday the World Health Organization revealed research suggesting that the death rate from this could be 3.4%. Now, that's of people who've been diagnosed, and so it's probably more widespread than that. And so therefore the death rate might be lower. The point being, if that is indeed the mortality rate, that's very, very serious, and an order of magnitude more serious than the flu, which is usually 0.1%, or 0.1%. And so Trump's misinformation, and frankly misunderstanding, if you've been watching the coverage of him talking to the scientists about this and meeting with pharmaceutical executives about a possible vaccine, it's quite clear he doesn't understand doesn't understand viruses, doesn't understand virology, and he's not a scientist.
No, to be sure.
But he's...
He also doesn't trust scientists.
Right, this is the problem.
There's an interesting sort of linkage here with the AIDS crisis. One of the people that the Trump administration has both talked to and also told not to talk very much is Anthony Fauci, who was...
Knows more about this than anybody.
Who knows more about infectious disease than anybody else in the United States, or at least he's in the top 10 people.
But he knows more than we do.
Yeah, well, that's for certain. In case you weren't wondering. But he had this basically the same role in the Reagan administration during the AIDS crisis, where he was saying, like, look, we need to take proactive steps to prevent people from dying. Here are the steps we need to take. And the Reagan administration telling him not to say those things publicly about condom usage and using clean needles and what have you. The other thing about the AIDS crisis that I think sort of precursors some of the things that we're seeing right now is that people who are suspected of having COVID-19 or people who are from demographic groups who are linked with COVID-19 are being targeted. So we've seen a number of cases recently of people of Chinese descent being attacked both in the United States and other places, or discriminated against as a consequence.
In Edinburgh, David.
Yes.
And
I think that actually had some very strong reverberations with some of these other diseases, where particular demographic groups get targeted as being potential carriers of the disease, or people who have the disease who are not going to spread it to you by day-to-day contact. I mean, the example that strikes me from the AIDS crisis was the case of Ryan White, who was I guess he was a middle school student who was diagnosed with AIDS in 1984. He was a hemophiliac. He had got it from a blood transfusion. And the school that he went to school in Indiana basically said, we don't want you to come to school. The parents, the teachers do not want, your classmates do not want you in school because we think you are a threat to us. Despite the fact that by 1984, they basically understood that one doesn't get AIDS from sitting next to somebody in a classroom. I think the fear of the disease, and I think that's really sort of the apex of the sort of fear of AIDS. Likewise, there's a huge amount of fear that's public right now about the COVID-19 virus is causing people to behave in pretty irrational ways, including some really ugly and violent ways on occasion.
Well, a student from Singapore was beaten up in London 2 days ago. And again, as I said, there have been some incidents here in Edinburgh that I'm aware of from reliable sources. I had a taxi driver in Stirling a couple of weeks ago who told me he won't pick up Chinese students.
Jesus Christ.
He did not get a tip. I mean, he said this as I was getting out of his taxi. And there have been some instances in the United States as well and elsewhere. The New York Times had a story about a Chinese student in Italy who's been ostracized and treated very badly. I think that's one of the things that's very worrying about this epidemic. Particularly because it's now spread beyond East Asia, it's not even it was never a rational response, but it's not as though it just doesn't make sense now. You're as likely to be infected by an Italian or a white American as somebody of Asian descent.
Now, given that the healthcare system in the United States has been obviously a major subject of political debate for the past generation, how does the healthcare system and the way it's structured in the United States shape both the public, the government's response to this crisis and the ways in which Americans are going to respond to COVID-19?
Yeah, I think this is a major problem because there was an instance the other day, and I can't remember. I think it was in Georgia, but I could be wrong about that. But the incident was basically somebody thought they might have it. So I think it was somebody who returned from a trip abroad, went to get tested, and got a, I think, $3,200 bill for the test.
Exactly.
And that story was widely reported. And so people are going to be unwilling or unlikely to get tested if they feel that they're going to get a huge bill for it. This is where public health actually helps all of us.
Yeah.
Now, in the past day, I think 24 hours ago, Mike Pence, who Donald Trump put in charge of this, and that's another issue given his attitude towards science, more or less said, you know, we're going to give out tests. But they don't have enough tests,
yes,
for one thing. But the perception that you have to pay or pay for your treatment is, will probably lead people not, particularly people who can't afford to pay their copay,
true,
or are uninsured, you know.
Or even if they can pay their copay, the hospital stays or, you know,
right,
bankrupting.
That's right. So it will put people off getting treated. And as a result, more people will be vulnerable. I read something this morning about there's a huge issue of homelessness in California.
Mm.
California is now under a state of emergency over this. Well, once this disease starts spreading among homeless people in places like San Francisco and Los Angeles, it's going to spread everywhere because those people, most homeless people don't have health insurance and health coverage.
Transient and are living in close quarters.
So you have uninsured people, you've got people with bad health insurance. You also got a lot of people in hourly paid jobs who cannot necessarily take time off work because they're ill.
Mm.
If a Typhoid Mary situation, people in the food service industry are often very low paid,
yes,
and cannot take sick days, and as a result are going to have to go to work when they're unwell, and they're going to be serving the public and they're going to spread this disease. So,
exactly.
So there are particular features. I mean, these are dangers everywhere, but there are particular features of the social and the medical social ecosystem in the United States that make it particularly fertile for the spread of this, of a disease of this type.
Right.
Particularly when people can have it, and first of all, it spreads easily. Secondly, there are mild cases of it that people may have, and they'll go to work because they think I don't feel great, but I don't feel terrible.
Yeah.
It's thought you can pass it on and somebody can get a much more virulent case even if you have a mild case. So the ecosystem for medical care in the United States is not well suited for a disease like this. By contrast, you know, I have some knowledge of the NHS through my wife, who's a GP here. I mean, they're worried about this. They're very worried about it, and they're trying to prepare for something. You know, my wife said, we don't have enough beds if this is really as widespread as it may be. But they're responding in a kind of national way, and by national I'm talking about both Scottish and British wide, in a way that we're not seeing in the United States, because the United States does not have a nationalized health service of any kind. And I'm not talking about socialized medicine, Medicare, I'm not talking about that, but we don't have a national network in place. We don't have the infrastructure, like most things
public health is disseminated and federalized into dozens of smaller systems.
It's decentralized and it's privatized and all those things, and it
with lots of cracks.
Yeah, and it makes it particularly ill-suited for this kind of outbreak. And we've also seen that, you know, so the Center for Disease Control is not just a nationally important institution. Mm. Frankly, it's an internationally important institution in dealing with epidemic diseases. But its budget's been cut by up to 80% during the Trump administration. And so its resources for dealing with this, you know, so what are limited. So one thing that has become a sort of central talking point, particularly in the Trumposphere, is people say, oh yeah, what about those panics about swine flu and H1N1? And, you know, people overreacted to those and nothing ever happened. Well, first of all, people did get sick with those diseases. But secondly, and particularly globally, secondly, they were dealt with because the infrastructure was in place to deal with them. And that infrastructure is no longer in place. Or at least at the moment, it's not in place. And so we have a particularly, I think the messaging coming from the Trump administration, worried about bolstering the markets, as you said, but also protecting the president's reputation, I think, and his re-election hopes, I think, and combined with Trump's lack of understanding of the nuance of this issue, and again, I can't confess to understand all the nuances of it, combined with the structure of the healthcare system and the widespread misinformation about it is a real problem. I mean, so I think it's, I think the thing is likely to spread widely anyway, but I think there are unique circumstances in the United States that make it particularly prone to this kind of outbreak.
And I think there's also a sort of resistance to both coming from the Trump administration and the philosophy of the Republican Party towards a robust government action. If we're thinking about sort of the ways in which other countries are responding to this, you know, you're thinking about Italy shutting down football, you can't see the Trump administration saying we're going to stop sporting events from happening.
Right, you know, I mean...
Or closing the schools.
March Madness is about to start. The NCAA basketball tournament.
Now,
will that go ahead?
Now, the NCAA is going to have to make that decision, but you can't imagine the government saying, no, you're not doing this.
That's right. That's right.
And you can imagine comparing them to, you know, Italy has been taking a fairly strong response in terms of shutting down. They're talking about shutting down the schools, the universities. Comparing that to then what China's been doing, you know, and obviously China has a very different kind of political structure. They've basically shut down large portions of their country.
At one point, 700 million people were on some form of lockdown and quarantine.
Indeed. You know, and you have these pictures of, you know, like air pollution level has changed in China as a consequence. You know, there's been like demonstrable, but that kind of
I want to interrupt and make clear, you know, Bernie Sanders got in trouble for allegedly praising Cuba recently. We are not praising the Chinese government or endorsing the actions of the Chinese government. Well, David might be.
I'm merely articulating that you know, in terms of the range of kinds of responses,
an authoritarian state can do that.
That, right. And the United States, even, you know, compared to other democratically structured systems, is very resistant to more widespread kinds of restrictions on people's liberties.
Although yesterday, I mean, you're absolutely right about that. What happened yesterday, which I think is interesting, is the governor of California announced that California is in a state of emergency. So we may see federal responses in the sense of states that make up the United States federal system will take action. So it's not that states won't act, but the state won't act necessarily in that kind of way.
But of course, the, you know, diseases don't know state borders.
That's right. And when it comes to things, you know, there are things that only the federal government can do because it's got the weight and it's got resources and so on. But it's particularly ill-suited, at least at this moment, to do so. I mean, I was thinking about the 1918 to 20 outbreak of the flu, because I remember for school I did an oral history project with my grandparents, as everybody always has to do for school. And my grandfather remembered being a boy in Boston. He remembers people being quarantined during that outbreak. And maybe that kind of mass quarantining will happen, but I doubt it.
Because, I mean, one of the things they did in that outbreak in terms of providing to prevent the spread, it was all down at the local level rather than at the national level for the most part. But they did things like have shops stagger when they were open so that not all the shops were open at the same time, so people weren't always shopping at the same time. And they told different people to shop on different days in different communities. And they, you know, had the schools run at staggered times and sort of make it so the classrooms weren't as crowded. You know, so there were local steps that were taken that would be extraordinary if they were taken today. Now, obviously, that flu outbreak was of an order of a magnitude more deadly than anything we've seen thus far with COVID-19. But, you know, they on at least on the local level, people in the United States were willing to accept pretty dramatic steps to try to limit the spread of that disease.
I was struck the other day, David. We're not talking about Super Tuesday this week. I'm sure we'll return to the election in the very near future.
Politics is everywhere.
However, you know, with the Super Tuesday voting, and one of the problems that manifested itself then were the massive lines, the long queues of people to vote, particularly in California and Texas. And I thought, wow, depending on, you know, you want to spread a disease, put people in a queue for 7 or 8 hours. That's a good way to do it.
Yes.
And it's led me to think that, combined with the fact that at the moment, the most likely candidates for president would seem to be, well, President Trump will be running, and either Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden. Bernie Sanders is 78 and has had a heart attack recently. Joe Biden is 77, and Donald Trump is a whippersnapper at 73, but doesn't seem to be the healthiest of the three. What do you think the impact, we can't know what's going to happen with this epidemic, but what do you think the impact of it could be on the election?
That's a remarkable question. I mean, so the odds of one of those three people getting sick or having some other kind of health emergency over the next 6 months is not zero.
No.
That's right. You know, and I think it's going to...
Well, particularly Biden and Bernie are spending... They're meeting hundreds of people a day. Right. And shaking hands and you know.
Yeah. Now Trump is a germaphobe and doesn't like to see people or touch them. So,
but he does go to these rallies.
He does go to these rallies, yes. And so we will. It's going to be a... If this... It's a very hard choice, one, because one has to make as a person running for public office, whether it's the presidency or anything else. Do you want... You're supposed... You know, the conventional wisdom is the way you get voters is by going and doing the sort of in-person campaigning, going door to door and talking to voters and understanding what they want.
Although Biden did incredibly well in places where he didn't have the resources to campaign on Super Tuesday, simply because he didn't have the money to do so.
Yeah, I think we're seeing all kinds of new ways in which the conventional wisdom about how politics is supposed to work and how campaigns are supposed to run.
Okay, I think thanks for that answer, and I think that's right. I mean, but that's thinking about those individuals, and of course, I named them. But what about more generally, either as an issue, if this gets worse, or actually how it's going to affect voters if people are sick?
Yeah, and people might be afraid to go to the polls in November.
Use the touch screen if that's how you vote.
Gee, yeah, exactly. you know, I think some states are, a few states I think have vote by mail. I think that's in Washington State and maybe Colorado. And I think that's a remarkably good option. I'm surprised that more states aren't embracing that, because I think the places where people are waiting in line for 5 or 6 hours to vote is both a kind of disenfranchisement and not a good use of people's time and public health. I think this is, one of the things I think this is exposing more broadly, it's in all these fissures in American society, whether it's the political system, whether it's the healthcare system, whether it's sort of systems of management, of business, and all kinds of ways in which the global economy is interconnected and the fragility that then sort of engenders. I think this outbreak is some exposing all these seams that people were not, if they weren't fully aware of, at least they're now becoming coming to the fore.
Well, Amazon has told its employees to stay home or work from home, and they've banned company travel. If your Amazon Prime delivery doesn't come, they haven't reached the warehouses yet, I'm quite sure, but things are going to...
All those are contractors. So
right. Interesting time.
So everyone, wash your hands.
Yes, please. Wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
And do it for a long time. Don't do the sort of symbolic washing of hands.
Yes.
Wash your hands. That's where all the public health professionals say, wash your hands and don't touch your face.
I touch my face all the time, but definitely wash your hands.
Yeah, wash your hands.
All right, well, it's time for last drops. What you got?
I've got two endorsements, one of which is completely unnecessary, but I'm excited about it. And they're both books.
Oh.
So the first is I want to endorse a book which some listeners will probably know, but I think it's the best book ever written about a presidential campaign.
Really?
And it's by Richard Ben Kramer, and it's called What It Takes. And it came out in the early 90s, and it was about the 1988 campaign, which frankly is not a very interesting campaign in and of itself. And that's, of course, when Mike Dukakis ran against the first George Bush and was defeated. But Kramer's profile of the candidates and all the candidates, his profiles, I should say, are amazing. And as an analysis, I can't recommend this book enough. And the reason it's on my mind is because among those who are profiled, and it was the first time he ran for president, is a then young senator from Delaware named Joe Biden.
He
did not do very well, but the profile of Biden is one of the most powerful in the book, because Kramer goes into great detail about, we know the tragedy of Biden's first wife and his daughter being killed in a car crash soon after he was elected in the 1970s, and the fact that he raised his two sons on his own. The reason he became Amtrak Joe on the train from Delaware to Washington was because he had two young boys at home that he was raising. It's a very powerful and quite sympathetic portrait of Biden, but it's worth revisiting. Although it is testimony to how old Joe Biden is, that he was running for president in 1988, and he's now the apparent front runner for the Democratic nomination here so many years later. So I can't recommend that book enough. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. If you're interested in the history of American politics, and it's beautifully written. It's long.
It's like War and Peace, but it's worth reading, and it flies by. Another long book, which, as I said, doesn't need my endorsement. It's received lots of attention, but I'm very excited about. Today is the 5th of March that we're recording, and Hilary Mantel's The Mirror and the Light has been published today. I'm awaiting my copy, and I'm very excited about this. I read the first two in her trilogy about Thomas Cromwell, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies. We've been waiting for this since 2012. I think as a sustained piece of writing about and an activity of our historical imagination, it's really, I can't think of anything like it in literature. It's not about American history, but I think it's the best work of historical fiction I can think of, and I'm very much looking forward to this.
Okay.
I may or may not, depending on coronavirus, be making my trip across the U.S. and Canada in the next couple of weeks, and I'm definitely bringing this book with me. And if I'm in quarantine,
exactly,
I'll have the time to read
material.
So that's good.
And listeners, if you see Frank, if you can fist bump, maybe you shouldn't fist bump, maybe you should
do, we'll do that elbow
thing. Right.
Yeah. I mean, well, this is one of the challenges on this trip. I usually meet hundreds of people and shake a lot of hands. And I'm going to have no handshaking or hugging.
You can bow or something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'll be very Victorian.
Namaste.
What's your last drop, David?
I also want to endorse a book which I've just started since I was in quarantine. I was doing some reading besides watching Star Trek of things that I probably wouldn't... wouldn't have been some summertime kind of reading here in I guess it was February. The book I want to endorse is Ben Park's new book, Kingdom of Naboo, which I've really only started, but the first couple chapters are really, really quite good. It's about the early history of Mormonism and their community in Naboo, which I think is a story that lots of Mormons know, but lots of other Americans don't.
Where
know.
Is Naboo, David?
Naboo
sounds like a Star Trek planet. Star Wars planet, not Star Trek. Sorry,
it could be both. It's in I guess Western Illinois.
Yeah.
So it was sort of on the frontier then. It was before they went. The Mormons went to Utah. They had this community in Naboo that was sort of a really important moment in Mormon history. That moment in which Joseph Smith is killed and all the kinds of things. Spoiler alert for people who haven't gotten that far in the book yet. But they have, it's really where the Mormon community develops. It's really where the sort of the both theologically and socially where that community comes to the fore. And I've really only started the book, but it seems like a really interesting story. It's something I've always been interested in, but never knew as much about as I should. I know Ben a little bit, but you know Ben pretty well.
I know Ben really well, and I'm so happy you endorsed this book. So, and I'm happy to endorse your endorsement. Ben was a student of ours. He was an MSc student before you arrived. So I taught Ben, and he's wicked smart. He was an excellent MSc student. He then went on to Cambridge and did a PhD. He wrote his first book, which is about nationalism in the early United States during the aftermath of the Revolution and early Republic. That was based on his PhD. I was his PhD external examiner. So I've known Ben for a good long time, and he is a brilliant young historian. And I'm really thrilled that this book is out.
Is it Sam Houston State?
Yes, that's right.
Texas,
Houston. And he's and a great guy.
And a very stylish dresser.
Yes, he is a very stylish dresser.
He got as many things from you, but probably not.
Not that. Oh, David, you're killing me.
No, yeah, David, you and I have the same fashion sense, Frank.
No, so I'm really pleased that Ben's book is out and it's getting a lot of attention and it's getting well-deserved attention. And Ben's a very fine scholar, so congratulations to Ben.
Great. Until next time, stay healthy, wash your hands.
Yeah. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.